Hello, this is Bob Kruger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food for January 2010. The first days of a new year seem an ideal time to start a new venture. This is a time that inspires some of us to try a new routine in our daily living. The first of a new year seems a good starting point for a positive change. So we will leave the year 2009 with its high points and low moments, its tears and its joys, and move into this new year of 2010. I remember 30 years ago wondering if I would live to see the year 2000. I not only reached 2000, but hung around for another 10 years. I feel the Lord still has something for me to do. This is a time for resolutions and inventories. Some say, why make New Year's resolutions? You know you'll break them. This may be true, but I view making a New Year's resolution as a positive move. At least I've given some thought to how I might like to change, and as a result will try harder to move in that direction. I'll admit that a couple of the items I mentioned were on my list last year. Hopefully, I made a bit of progress last year. Rabbi Mark Gelman, whose column God Squad appears weekly in the News Observer, titled a column, Resolutions Are Good for Every Day. He begins, I'm not a fan of New Year's resolutions. He challenged his readers to send them their resolutions, and he will share some of them in future columns. He then suggested that his big four would be eat less, exercise more, swear less, and give more. He also suggested that we call people we like more often for no real reason. Another suggestion is to shut up more and listen harder. I could use all of his suggestions. Some businesses take a year-ending inventory. They need to know whether they made a profit on their year's business transactions. They now have an accurate picture of the stock they have on hand. Is this merchant current and up to date, or is it merchandise that's no longer in demand? On a personal side, an inventory can be helpful. Do I carry with me each day feelings of anger, distrust, resentment, and envy? Do we realize that such feelings, regardless of their reason, make us less hopeful than we might be? This sort of personal inventory is very difficult to do. Unfortunately, we all have traits that we'd rather not mention. It would seem that I've been preaching, so enough of that. Let's take up the idea of inventory. Do you know everything that's in your pantry shelf or in the freezer section of your refrigerator? From personal experience, I know how easy it is to lose something in one's freezer. Let me suggest that you remove everything from your freezer. Make a list of each item. It may well be you'll find an item or two that's freezer burned. An item that is freezer burned is one that's been frozen so long it's begun to dry out. And even if usable, the item will not have the flavor that it had when it was placed in the freezer. From your list of items in your freezer and on your pantry shelf, you can plan a number of meals using the items you already have on hand. Last week, I prepared a pot roast with vegetables in our slow cooker and later a pot of ham bone soup. The main ingredients for both meals had occupied space in the freezer. In both cases, there were leftovers for at least one more meal. During the time I am writing this article, we are experiencing some very cold weather. What better time to prepare soup? Our favorite soups are comfort meals. A comfort meal has been described as something that fills and satisfies our hunger pans. There's another reason for soup at any time. Because it's low in calories and high in water content, it fills you up before it fills you out. Soup is also a good tasting vehicle for vegetables and other fiber-filled ingredients. Most varieties of soup score well on the nutritional balance sheet. Soups tend to be good sources of minerals and vitamins. With the exception of cream soups, they're low in saturated fat and cholesterol, and it's cheap. Basic ingredients of soup, water, herbs, spices, vegetables, and beans are inexpensive. Soup is even more economical if you add leftovers, odd bits of vegetables, rice, or pasta to the soup pot. If you prefer a meat-based soup, it doesn't require any great amount of meat to flavor the pot. Soup is also a convenient, quick meal. It requires little stovetop supervision, and you can even make it in a slow cooker. It's easy to make from scratch. Follow a basic recipe if you care to, but a little more than of this ingredient or less of that is nothing to be concerned about. Soup is forgiving. Make your own soup stock, some call it broth, by simmering meat bones and scraps of meat. cool in the refrigerator, skim off any fat that rises to the top, remove the bones and the stock is not ready for use. If you want to freeze it for later use, put it in airtight containers and date and label the containers. I find that empty, large plastic peanut butter containers work very well for this purpose. For variety, add barley, rice, or bits of pasta. Kids like alphabet-shaped pasta. The biggest drawback to soup is sodium content. You have a lot more control when soup is homemade rather than from a can. When you make it yourself, you can cut the sodium level by using reduced-sodium canned tomatoes, rinsing any canned beans you might add. The bean soup served in the dining room of the United States Senate building in Washington, D.C. has a famous reputation. Navy beans, ham hocks, a little onion, and a lot of water are the ingredient list of this soup. Although the origin of the soup is not clear, what is known is that it was introduced to the U.S. Capitol dining room by a couple of Midwestern senators about 100 years ago. Everyone must have liked the soup because with astonishing speed, the Senate agreed that not only that it be served every day, but the recipe not be tampered with. The ham hock gives the soup a subtle smoky taste, and if you're lucky, there may be a few bits of pork floating around in your bowl. When properly seasoned with salt and pepper, the soup is quite satisfying. After a morning of billion-dollar spending debates, we figure senators are ready to shift gears and sit down to a simple bowl of bean soup. If I ever get to the Senate dining room, I'll have a bowl of this famous bean soup. You can dilute the sodium load of soup by ensuring the rest of the meal is low in sodium. For example, serve soup with crusty bread and fresh fruit salad or a mixed green salad tossed with oil and vinegar. Soup is great in cold weather. Many of we who live in the Triangle, including myself, are outlanders, folks who came from other places. So the traditional New Year's meal of black-eyed peas, smoked hog joe, collards, and cornbread may seem a bit unusual. Legend says that the humble black-eyed pea became a New Year's staple at the end of the Civil War. Sherman's advancing troops ignored the peas, which were raised mostly as food for slaves and livestock as they took to the South livestock and other crops. Now seen as symbols of luck and prosperity, they are usually served with hearty greens and cornbread, all dishes that can be made with locally available ingredients even in the dead of winter. It's a southern tradition to eat this meal on New Year's Day. The meal is said to bring the luck and prosperity for the entire year. And here are a few of the legends surrounding the food. Black-eyed peas are the most important components of the meal. The legumes represent coins, some folks say. Some cooks throw a penny or a dime in the pot for extra luck. It's a good omen for the diner who receives it. Others believe you must eat at least 365 of the peas to have good luck every day of the year. That sounds like an awful large bowl of peas to me. Collard greens are a rather strong-flavored green that many serve with black-eyed peas. They're said to represent folding money. Collard greens are another of those vegetables that are an acquired taste, but they're quite popular in eastern North Carolina. Drive through some of the rural areas east of Raleigh and look at the gardens. You'll see plenty of collards. They can stand the cold weather better than most vegetables. Another traditional side dishes of the first day of the year is cornbread. This bright yellow bread represents gold. Many traditional cooks fry slices of smoked hog joe. It has the flavor of smoked bacon, but is rather fat. They often use some of the grease to favor the collards. Whether you had the traditional New Year's Day meal or not, we wish all of our listeners a very good 2010. Dine out, and eventually you run into a slow, inattentive server, the one who seems to mysteriously disappear when you want to place an order, to get a refill or drop off for the check. It's enough to make you wish you could press a button and make your server appear. At Applebee's restaurants throughout Central Florida, now you can. This fall, Applebee's franchise rolled out a system designed to improve service. Servers wear watches that vibrate when the customers press buttons at electronic boxes on their tables. It puts the guest in constant contact with the server, says James White, general manager of Orange City's Applebee's that got the system a couple of months ago. The idea that we don't have to wait, we don't have to flag somebody down, that's awesome, said Jan Higgins, 44, of Deltona, eating lunch with her parents, husband, and two-year-old daughter. Eating out with a toddler can sometimes get just bonkers. After lunch makes us waiting is particularly annoying, Higgins said. Some restaurant experts are skeptical. A real good server is one that's an attentive and anticipatory server without being prompted by electric devices, Dennis Lombardi, an Ohio-based restaurant consultant. This kind of tries to use an automated process to provide that same attentive component of it. The system may help improve customer service, Lombardi said, but restaurants can do that in other more personalized ways, such as training, team building, and simply hiring the right people. Will it make servers become less attentive and just become reliant on the buzzer? Will customers have less patience if a buzzer doesn't get answered promptly? Rick Van Warner, president of the Parquet Group in Orlando, Florida, Orlando, Florida-based restaurant and retail consulting firm, says, I have a lot of questions. Casual Restaurant Concepts of Tampa, Florida, which owns the Orlando Applebee's franchises, would not provide specifics, but said the new system has resulted in fewer guest complaints in the restaurants. It's first introduced the system created by ESP Digital Media of Charlotte, North Carolina, in its Tampa restaurants 2 years ago. The system is in its pilot stage in other markets. Restaurant consultants said they did not know of any other major change using such a system. Applebee's is by far and away the biggest customer, said Drew Palmer, the co-founder of ESP. The small black boxes also allow customers to fill out surveys, and if ratings are low, managers will come out and talk to the customers. Customers use the system a lot. At first, server Carrie Bouvais said, it was like a new toy. Now the servers have gotten used to it, she said. It's just part of our everyday routine. In some restaurants, customer Virginia Wesson said she'd gotten irritated trying to get a server's attention. You could even call them by name, she said, and sometimes they don't respond. This way, they have no choice. The Raleigh company that runs 8 Applebee's in the Triangle and 49 across North Carolina is testing the electronic system aimed at improving how its wait staff works in several locations, including its restaurants in Wake Forest and Jacksonville. They make sure you can't be ignored. My friends, what do you think of this idea? Would you like to have a buzzer at the table of the restaurant where you are eating? Had your dining experience in the past been so slow that you had wished for a buzzer? If you'd like to express an opinion, please call the reading service at 919-832-5138 and leave a message for me. Every 10 years, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reassesses the goals and reports on progress in the previous decade. Many call the effort a success. The report has been imitated by some states and other nations. 10 years ago, the government set some lofty health goals for the nation to reach by 2010. So how did we do? By many measures, not so hot. And there are more obese Americans than a decade ago, not fewer. We eat more salt and fat, not less. Most of us have high blood pressure. I should say more of us have high blood pressure. More of our children have untreated tooth decay. But the country's made at least some progress in many other goals. Vaccination rates improve, most workplace injuries are down, and death rates from stroke, cancer, and heart disease are all dropping. As we move into a new decade, the government is analyzing how well the nation met the 2010 goals and drawing up a new set of plans for 2020, expected to be more numerous and perhaps less ambitious. We need to strike a balance of setting targets that are achievable and also asking the country to reach, said Dr. Harold Cole, the federal official who oversees the Healthy People Project. That's a balance that's sometimes a challenge to strike. The Healthy People's objectives were first created in the late 1970s to set an agenda for getting Americans to live healthier, longer lives. It also in an attempt to involve the public and emphasize that many health problems are preventable. After more than 30 years, the goals aren't well known to the public and only a modest number have been met. About 41% of the 1990 measurable goals were achieved. For the 2000 goals, it was just 24%. As for the 2010 goals, data are still being collected and the final report is not due until next year, but it looks as if the results will be shy of 20%, according to a preliminary analysis by the Center for Disease Control's National Center for Health Statistics. The Healthy PFAS effort could be better if it included more information on how to reach the goals and how much it would cost, said Dr. David Holtgrave, a health policy expert at Johns Hopkins University. The program lays out goals but looks to others in the public to find ways to achieve them. Healthy People does not provide funding to meet the goals either. It's all carrot and no stick, said Dr. Richard Riegelman, the founding dean of George Washington University's School of Public Health, who has been a part of the healthy team planting. It would seem to me that each individual person must take a serious look at their individual physical condition, then try to make individual goals that would result in better health. The big question for me and probably many others is, do I have the self-discipline to stay with it? Have you noticed that the number of items on grocery store shelves have shrunk? Recently, products ranging from mayonnaise to breakfast cereal have been stuffed into containers that hold an ounce or two less but cost the same. Such an example is Unilever, the food products giant that makes Breyers and Dyers ice cream and also cuts its Hellmann's mayonnaise from 32 ounces to 30 ounces. And Country Crock spread now weighs 2 pounds 13 ounces instead of 3 pounds. Unilever certainly isn't the only food product manufacturer who follows this practice. Shrinking a container is less obvious to consumers than raising prices, said Chris Waldorp, the director of the Consumers Federation of America's Food Policy Institute. He doesn't fault food makers, but if you're going to do it, be honest and transparent about it, he said. Most companies don't publicly announce shrinkage. But there is a form of shrinkage that we can applaud. We may not have noticed, but bottles of Coke are slimming down. The cap on the new 20-ounce bottle is a tad smaller these days and 24% lighter. Kraft Foods' new salad dressing bottles have gone on a diet as well. They use 19% less plastic and take up less space in shipping containers. Ordinary packing modifications can lead to important savings for big food companies as they grapple with rising commodity and energy costs. Companies have always put a focus on cutting packaging costs, but in this environment, they're certainly putting more and more focus on this aspect of their business, said Joseph Hotchkiss, the chairman of Cornell University's Food Science Department and spokesman for the Institute of Food Technologists in Chicago. In the food business, packaging costs, including everything from raw materials for bottles and boxes to the amount of space product takes up in trucks and on shipping pallets. Broadly defined, packaging costs often outweigh ingredient costs, Mr. Hoskins said. A penny saved off packaging can translate into millions of dollars in savings for a large volume consumer product. One tactic is source reduction, reducing the amount of plastic, aluminum, paper, or other materials used to make a container. That usually has a positive byproduct in reducing waste. Last year, Coca-Cola began putting smaller caps on plastic bottles holding 24 ounces or less of its soda and Asante water. It was a major project. Engineers had to ensure a proper seal to avoid leakage or a cap blow-off. There's a lot of sophistication to the design of a bottle cap that's often overlooked, says Scott Vitters, Coca-Cola's director of sustainable packaging. The payoff is a lid that is effectively 24% lighter and thus a big reduction in plastic use. Last year, Coke cut plastic intake by 4 million pounds. This year, 2009, as the cap roll was off out is completed, those savings should rise to 40 million pounds. Coke declined to translate that into dollars. Kraft, with its new salad dressing container, has cut its plastic consumption by 3.4 million pounds annually, the equivalent of 70 million plastic beverage bottles. The new package, through an engineering redesign of the bottle shape, also takes up so much less space that Kraft suppliers can ship 18% more dressing bottles per truckload, another source of savings. Kraft calls the dollar savings moderate, but says the changes help offset the increased cost of new labels and reformulated recipes for its salad dressings. Kraft's dressing bottles are emblazoned with the word still 16 ounces. The company doesn't want consumers to think the new packaging means less dressing. In a new recent news story, we learned that the year 2009 was a good year for movies. Although the economy wasn't up to what we're used to, many of us went to the movies. For many, a trip to the movies is not complete without a large soft drink and a large container of popcorn. Popcorn can be a healthy snack, but not when you get it at the movies. Movie popcorn has a lot of fat and salt that our systems don't need. A medium movie popcorn and medium soft drink can easily add at least 1,000 calories, and that's a lot of extra salt to your diet. An average person will try to limit sodium, that is salt, to a little over 200 milligrams a day. For many of us, through years of eating foods with salty condiments and seasonings, have reinforced a preference for the taste of salt. Cutting out salt was hard to do unless you do it gradually. Try drinking a low-sodium V8 if you need proof. Over time, though, you can reprogram your salt sensors. Cut back for starters. Leave the salt out when you cook pasta, oatmeal, and vegetables. Put away the salt shaker and begin buying low-sodium soy sauce and canned goods. As you begin using less salt, experiment with other ways to enhance the flavor of the foods you are preparing. Nothing exactly replaces the taste of salt, but you can complement the natural flavor of foods. Here are some ideas. Add a squeeze of citrus, lemon juice on broccoli, salad greens and on fish, lime juice on fresh slices of papaya, and pieces of fresh orange and grapefruit on a tossed green salad. Use aromatic spices liberally. Try the flavor of curry powder, cumin, cayenne pepper or chili powder, oregano, and basil. Sweeten with spices and fruit. Spike hot oatmeal with cinnamon and nutmeg. You can add cinnamon to a pot of chili. Add diced apples and raisins to peel off. Couscous and casseroles. Mash a ripe banana and add to the oatmeal. Add a tablespoon of peanut butter to a bowl of a hot cereal. Give foods a shot of vinegar. It adds punch to whatever you pour it on. Cooked greens, home fries, salad, or low-sodium soup. Use different kinds of vinegar for different effects. All vinegars are pungent, but malt vinegar is especially good on potatoes, and balsamic cider or rice vinegars taste good on tossed salads. Of course, most foods don't need help of herbs and spices to make them taste good. Many of us just so used to covering up the real flavor of foods that we've forgotten how good plain foods can taste. Stop the cover-up. Pay attention to how foods taste and reset your palate for a diet that isn't dependent on the taste of salt. Read carefully the items of your favorite seasoning. You might find something surprising, such as a high sodium content. We need to remember that high sodium diets can increase your blood pressure and are associated with greater risk of cardiovascular and disease and stroke. Take heed, dieters, that lean cuisine might not be as lean as you think. The food at many popular chain restaurants and in the freezer section of the supermarkets may contain a lot more calories than advertised, according to a new study. The study of 10 chain restaurants, including Wendy's and Ruby Tuesday, found that a number of calories in 29 meals or other menu items was an average of 18% higher than listed. Frozen supermarket meals from Lean Cuisine, Weight Watchers, Healthy Choice, and South Beach Living had 8% more calories than the label said, according to the study published in this month's Journal of the American Dietetic Association. It's not that the food companies are conspiring to sabotage your diet, at least not in this case. Researchers and other experts said most of the discrepancies can be explained by variations in ingredients, portion sizes, and testing methods. For example, the teenager behind the counter may have been over generous with the mayonnaise. Still, if every time you eat out you get a couple hundred calories or more than you think, that can add up easily, said Susan Roberts, the leading researcher and professor of nutrition at Tufts University. There's a big drumbeat for people putting calories on menus, but it's only useful if the calories are right. The Raleigh-Durham International Airport announced in mid-December that a Burger King restaurant will open in the late fall of 2010 on Aviation Parkway next to the Sheets Station at National Guard Drive. The airport authority approved a 20-year lease with Charlotte-based Prospect Foods, LLC, a Burger King franchisee. Prospect Foods is expected to start construction this spring. Airport officials hope to find a third tenant for the site, which it calls Aviation Station. Another question for the food experts. When making a souffle, is it best to use cold eggs or room temperature eggs? The answer. The trick to a souffle is the egg foam or meringue from the beaten white eggs, egg whites. That's what holds air and allows the souffle to rise, so you want eggs that are room temperature or even warmer for several reasons. Cold eggs make it harder to separate the yolks and the whites, and cold egg whites take longer to beat. Also, as food editor and author Shirley Corr explains in her book Bakewise, published by Scribner in 2008, a warm souffle base and warm egg whites will make your souffle rise faster and taller when it goes into a hot oven. If you don't have time to let your eggs sit at room temperature for a half hour or so, you can place them in a bowl of warm or tepid water for a few minutes to take the chill off before separating them and beating the egg whites. Earlier we talked about losing something in our freezer, and I found that if I don't watch carefully, a perfectly good leftover can stay in the refrigerator so long that it must be thrown out. A small container can become hidden behind a larger one. I suggest that when lunchtime comes, look for a leftover that would make a part of your lunch, or check what you have that could easily become part of your evening meal. As we place more emphasis on recycling and finding a use or a place for everything we discard comes this question. What do you do when you use tea leaves and coffee grounds? Both coffee grounds and tea leaves can be used as mulch in your garden, whether it be with vegetables or flowers. A soil test will determine if the tea leaves and coffee grounds, which have a slightly acid content, will be good for your garden and plants. If you have a compost bin, add the leaves and the grounds into the bin. Let me encourage you to look in your newspapers for coupons on items you use. This is a way in which we can economize. Sometimes we make the mistake of buying something we don't use or need just because we have a coupon. It can be a good feeling to see the total on your receipt and then the new total after the coupons have been subtracted. We here at the Triangle Radio Reading Service wish all of you a happy and productive year in 2010. And see you next month about this time. And until next time, this has been Bob Kruger with Thought for Food. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. And so long till the next time. And it appears that I've still got a second or two here, and I just want to say that it's been my pleasure to have been with you, and I hope that what I've shared with you will be of some value. I would encourage all of you to plan your meals before you go grocery shopping so that you don't pick up extra items that you may not need, because the impulse when you see something is to pick it up. And sometimes when we do that, we pick up a lot of stuff that is heavier than we need.